I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of an Iraqi father who is missing, a family that waits for him, and a son who watches. Sarmad Ali still has no idea what happened to his father. He's been missing now for over a year. Sarmad is among the Iraqis who managed to leave his country. He came to the U.S. to study, and he has a great job at the Wall Street Journal. But as the eldest son, he was feeling guilty about having left behind a brother and sisters and his parents. Then early one morning in New York, his phone rang.
My brother was like shouting and crying on the phone. And then I couldn't understand anything. I thought that the bomb hit the house and somebody died. And then he told me finally that my father went to work that day. He never came back.
Sarmad continues to hope and to follow the search for his father. He wants to go home but knows there's next to nothing he could do if he was there. I'll talk with him about this right after the news. I have a hard time imagining the kind of turmoil that Sarmad Ali lives with. Like me, he's a journalist. He works here in the U.S. We both often find ourselves writing about the same story about the war in Iraq. I do it on the radio. Sarmad has a blog at the Wall Street Journal. Except for Sarmad, it's excruciatingly personal. His entire family is still in Baghdad. His father's been missing for a year. His younger brother wants him to come home and help.
Sometimes he didn't pick up the phone when I called. Sometimes he avoided me because he was angry at me because I left. I've been really thinking about this a lot. I do feel sometimes guilty, but at the same time, I feel like if I were there, what could I do possibly to help them? I'll be like as stuck as they are.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
When Sarmad Ali was a kid in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, he had a secret stash of magazines. I know what you're thinking, not those kinds of magazines. He had some old copies of Time magazine that he read over and over. Sarmad was able to pursue his fascination with the English language. He studied it at Baghdad University, and in the months before the war, he had a job lecturing there. It wasn't until sometime after the invasion that he made it back to see what was left of the campus.
It was so depressing because the day I went, everybody, like students, professors, they were standing in the hallways in front of the library, the college library and the department, the English department, which was looted and burned. And they were standing in front of the department in the hallways because there was nowhere else to sit. The professors, they didn't have their desks, they didn't have their chairs, nothing was left for them.
So when did you think, Sarmad, that it would be a good time to leave Iraq, to spend some time studying abroad?
I actually grew up with the dream, like even under Saddam, with the dream of leaving Iraq. When I was a kid, we had like some old magazines, like Time magazine, other old books in English, and I used to dig in my basement at home because my mother hid some books in English and books about communism, and because my uncle was a communist and he left the country. He left Iraq in 1979. I grew up seeing these like books in English and articles in English, and I used to spend summers and summers, days and days, just reading in English because of my interest in other cultures. I used to spend the whole like summer vacation just instead of going and playing with the kids, just sitting with the English-Arabic dictionary or English-English dictionary and looking up new words, making lists of new words, reading articles in old magazines and just reading them over and over because of the lack of access to new English material. So I had the dream to study abroad long before the war.
Do you remember any one copy of Time magazine, like what was on the cover or what the date was?
Yeah. I remember it was like the pages were kind of brown because it was like the old editions. And I remember one cover, it was Anwar Sadat, the Egyptian former president, and he was picked as the person of the year that year. And I remember that, his picture on Time magazine's like cover.
I think it was the year before he was assassinated.
Probably. I don't remember.
But tell me, Sarmad, you're the eldest son in the family. Was it difficult for you to go to your father and mother and say, look, you know, this is a good time for me to leave to go study?
It was very hard to make that decision. First of all, I knew that I might not go back like soon if I left Iraq. And I knew that my family relied on me in some ways. I was working and I was providing for the house. My father's job wasn't enough. So it was kind of a blow to go to my family and say, hey, I'm leaving you now.
What did your father say? Did he encourage you to leave in the long run?
He actually did. My family is kind of open-minded. I think he was more scared, afraid that something bad would happen to me because he had never left Iraq before. So he was probably shocked that I was at that young age, 25 years old, trying to go to the U.S.
Not only had Sarmad's father never left Iraq, during the worst of the bombing of the capital city, he never left Baghdad. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. In the weeks leading up to the war, and this was 5 years ago now, in those days, many citizens of Baghdad left the city. They'd heard that the U.S. was preparing to bomb it. Sarmad remembers that his dad felt differently.
My father was against leaving the house. He said, I'd rather die here than leaving. Like, you couldn't leave by yourself. Like,
yeah.
You had to go as a family. And at the end, just a day before the war, under pressure from my older sister and younger sister, seeing that most neighbors had already left, I went to a nearby bus station, and hired a minibus for the family. And my father was still at work at that point, and he wasn't at home. When he came, we were, loading the stuff to the minibus, and we were about to leave. I remember my sister, older sister, on the way to Diyala, Baquba, 60 kilometers north of Baghdad, where we went. She was crying on the way to Baquba because she remembered my father. He was, cooking for himself, washing his clothes and these things.
So the family went north, but your father did stay behind in Baghdad.
Yeah, he did. He said, I'd rather die here. I wouldn't leave. Also, he was afraid that there will be looting and these things.
Yeah.
He couldn't leave the house, but just with nobody there.
So how long were you apart then? How long did you stay in the north?
We stayed there till the U.S. troops came to Baghdad. It was only 40 minutes away from Baghdad.
But when you came back to Baghdad, were you thinking?
We saw the troops on we were driving back, and the American tanks were driving too with us.
Were you thinking to yourself, there are really good days ahead for us?
Not really. When we came there, when we came back, we saw that everything was burned. Everything, it was so depressing. The ministries, the government buildings, looted and burned. Everything there, it was set on fire. Garbage everywhere. No sanitary system, nothing. Nothing was functioning. No water, no electricity. No security. There was a curfew at 4 p.m. You couldn't leave the house after 4. It wasn't really promising picture of what Iraq would be.
And all the time that you were away, I don't know, 40, 45 days, your father was in Baghdad. And during that period of time, there was bombing every night. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, every night, heavily. And actually, I visited him with my brother twice while we were in Baquba, just to see how he was doing and how things were. I went I went to Baghdad to my house and went back to Baquba the same day because I had to leave before sunset. There were no cars going back and forth between Baghdad and Baquba after sunset. So I went there, and he actually, he was waiting to fill some buckets with water because there was no water in the tap at that point. And he said, don't bring anybody here. It's horrible at night.
What did you think at the time, Sarmad? Did you think that your father was very brave for staying there, or that perhaps he was foolish for staying in Baghdad?
I didn't think either way. I thought that he didn't really care that much because Iraqis have become accustomed to wars and bombings and these things. I opened my eyes to this world with the Iran-Iraq war, seeing missiles falling next door. blackouts and all these crazy things. So I think for him, as a person in his early 60s, I don't think it did matter to him whether he died there or he left.
When you and the rest of the family came back in April and saw your father together as a family, had he been changed by all that time living under the bombing?
He was. He was unhappy with the situation. The first thing he told me, like when I entered the house, he was like, they looted everything. Iraqi locals who looted. And he said they looted everything from TVs to computers, even water pipes. And he was like really depressed to see all that happening in front of his eyes.
Was there a time when he thought, you know, maybe we should all leave Baghdad together and stay away from the city?
I don't think so. He's really attached to his homeland. He's really attached to his country and to his home. I think if he didn't leave during the U.S. bombings, I would highly doubt it that he would leave afterwards, after the invasion.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. As I mentioned earlier, Sarmad had been working, teaching English at the university, but after the war began and after that campus was looted, Sarmad worked for the English language newspaper, Iraq Today. But then came threats of bombs and kidnappings, and Sarmad found himself at risk.
One day I was at home, it was Friday, it was around 3, and my brother came, he stopped by, I was reading in my room, and he was like, he rarely did that. He rarely interrupted me while I was reading, unless it's really urgent or something. And he was like, hey, my friend noticed that there were like a couple people who are following you in the cafe, somewhere else, and they were the same people. I was like really shocked because... and scared because I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't work for a military or any American like papers or something.
Yeah.
Our paper was like started and run by Iraqis. All the staff were Iraqi except the editor, who was also Iraqi-American. And I didn't have enemies. I didn't have any trouble. I couldn't understand why they would do that, why I would be followed. And I was scared. I thought that I should talk to some close friends. So I went to my close friends in the neighborhood and said, this is what my brother told me. And they volunteered to skip work for some days and follow these people and follow me and see who these people are and stop them and these things. But then I said, there's no reason. I don't think I've done anything wrong. And I'll be more careful and I'll watch and see who these people are. But I never really could identify them or I never saw them. And within a week or so, I got my visa to the U.S., so I came here.
The most difficult time for Sarmad Ali, though, was getting the news that his father was missing in Baghdad. I'll ask him to tell me more about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Sarmad Ali still doesn't know what happened to his father. All he knows is that one day, about a year ago, his dad went to work in Baghdad and never came home. Sarmad himself is one of the few Iraqis who was able to get out of Iraq after the war began. At least he's one of the few who hasn't wound up as a refugee in a neighboring country. Back in 2004, Sarmad got a visa to study journalism at Columbia University in New York. He made his way to Jordan, but as he told me, he had a lot to learn.
I'd never bought a plane ticket at that point. I had never been to an airport. So I went to the hotel manager. I said, listen, I really want to buy a plane ticket. How do you buy plane tickets? And he said, where are you going? I said, well, I'm going to the U.S. He said, you're going to the U.S. and you don't know how to buy a plane ticket. I said, yeah, I'd never left Iraq before. And then the British Airways, they called me and they said, we have a ticket for you. Although it was somehow expensive, but I had to take it.
Yeah.
And I flew to Heathrow in London and then to JFK. And I was shocked when I got to Heathrow because the automatic doors opening without me doing anything. Although I've seen them in movies, but I wasn't expecting it. and all these like new books and magazines and everything there. And we were like in darkness for ages. We're like living in darkness, no new magazines, no new books, nothing. And then I saw all these lights and all these things in the airport. I was shocked. When I landed, they took me in for interrogation for 3 hours or so. I expected some hassle, like some trouble, because I didn't have a passport, first of all. Second, because I was from Iraq. They kept asking me questions of where I would be staying and these things. And at that point, I didn't really know. And I said, I really don't know. If I did, I would have told you. I don't need to like keep it to myself or lie. And then one of the officers, he was like kind of suspicious. He whispered in his colleague's ears sarcastically. He was like, he doesn't know where he was staying. I was like, yes, I don't know. And then I did something kind of smart when I was in Jordan. I faxed my flight information to my professor at Columbia, and I asked him to come and help me. And I didn't hear back from him when I boarded the plane to the U.S., and I didn't know whether he would be able to help me or whether he got my fax. And he showed up. He came there around like a bit late. I was being interrogated, but he came, and then he said, there's a professor waiting for you outside from Colombia. And then he drove me home to his house.
Yeah.
And I slept there that night because I didn't have a place to sleep in that night.
That first night was just the first of many new experiences for Sarmad Ali as he adjusted to life in the U.S. Back home in Baghdad, his younger brother took on the responsibility of being the eldest son. Even in those early days, it was difficult for Sarmad to keep in touch.
Sometimes it's really hard because my home landline in Iraq hasn't been working for forever. And the only phone in my family's possession is my brother's cell phone. And because I left, he had some, he's kind of temperamental and he's kind of scared of him being in charge of my family with my absence. And he's like really scared. He's just a teenager. And sometimes he didn't pick up the phone when I called. Sometimes he avoided me because he was angry at me because I left. So it was really hard sometimes to get in touch with my family. Sometimes I call my friends in the neighborhood and I ask them to bring my mother at specific time and talk to her. But they don't use email. So
it must be hard to have those kinds of conversations because you work so hard at trying to get the people together. You know, it must be emotional too.
It is, but at the same time, I understand their difficulties. I lived through the war. I understand what is it like to live in darkness, to have no water, to wake up in the morning and there is a bomb next door. I know all these things. So whenever he's angry at me, I understand and I try to appease him and I try to just accommodate him and try to understand his situation.
Why was he angry with you? Did he feel like you deserted the family? What was he thinking?
Well, basically, I think he has a conflicting feeling because I remember the day I left Iraq, I remember him insisting on carrying my suitcase. It was a huge one. And he wanted to carry it to the cab and he hugged me. And I don't think this is what he means when he does. I think he's under a lot of pressure. He's under unusual circumstances. And I understand that he feels that he shouldn't be left at this age to take care of a mother and two sisters. And he wanted me to be there, basically, to help them and support them psychologically, financially, and to get through this. So I understand why he would do something like that.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. One day, in December 2006, Sarmad Ali got an early morning phone call from Baghdad.
I was actually asleep, and I was awakened by a phone call. It was like around 5 or 5:30 in the morning here. And my brother was like shouting and crying on the phone. And then I couldn't understand anything. I thought that a bomb hit the house and somebody died. And then he told me finally that my father went to work that day. He never came back. He never showed up at work and he never came back home that evening. And there were a couple bombings that went off near a central bus station where he was supposed to transfer to another bus to get to work.
What did the family think? What did you think?
I was really scared and saddened. I didn't know what to tell him, except I remember telling him to get in touch with friends and try to go to the area where the bombing was, try to go to some nearby hospitals where the victims were taken, and try to go to the police and ask the police and see if he's like on the list of people who were taken by mistake, like just into custody.
I can't imagine what it would be like to get that phone call, because here you are in New York, you can't go back to Baghdad. We're all reading the news stories every day about bombs and people who are disappearing. It must have been awful for you.
Yeah, it has been really a difficult time since I heard the news. And I was really actually more concerned about my family. Like, I started to hope that my family would keep the strength, and especially my mother and my sisters. I don't know. I was thinking that he could be kidnapped, but I don't know. I wasn't sure. I can't really tell. I haven't been to Iraq for 3 years.
And what did you hear from your family? How were people holding up?
Well, basically, like, my sister, my older sister, has been on antidepressants since my father went missing. And she's been really sick. And she's been refusing to take medicine. And when she took it, she stopped again, and she went sick again. And then my mother, seeing all the mess around her, she also stopped taking her epilepsy medicine. She has epilepsy. And she got epilepsy fits and hallucinations and all that crazy stuff. And then some neighbors, hearing her shouting sometimes in the middle of the night or something, they intervened and they wanted to help her, and she went back on medicine now.
And still, the weeks would go by, the months went by, and no word about your father.
No, except like last August, one of my close friends, he received a phone call from a morgue, a hospital morgue, saying that there is a body that they found was a charred body that could resemble my father. And he tried to call me, and I was asleep again. It was like 3 in the morning, New York time. And when he couldn't get in touch with me, he took the news to my family, although I warned him not to take any news to my family unless he's sure that this is accurate.
But somebody would have to go to the morgue, right, to see if this was your
father.
Yeah,
right. This is why he went to them. He went to them to say, I received this phone call from the hospital. Would you come with me, one of you, to the hospital to identify the body? My brother refused to go because he was fearful that this could be his father. And my friend went with my cousin a couple of times to the morgue to identify the body, but was really blackened, as they described it. And they said, even if I were there, I wouldn't be able to tell what that body was. And the doctor said there is a scar on the face, on the cheek. One of the cheeks, and I know that my father doesn't have any scar on his face, and they concluded that this shouldn't be my father. We tried to get some dental records to make the identification, but even his dentist had left his clinic because of death threats against doctors and these things. So we were left with uncertainty again.
This means that you don't know at this point if that was your father, but you suspect it wasn't, the body that was charred that had been caught in the bomb blast.
Yeah, basically.
And this was last summer, right?
It was in August.
And nothing since then?
No.
I remember you telling me at the beginning, Sarmad, that your father wouldn't even leave Baghdad during the period of bombing. So I'm thinking that he probably didn't leave the city.
No. Where would he go? He was heading to work. It never crossed my mind.
So you're kind of left with the conclusion that your father's probably dead then.
Or kidnapped, yeah.
But there's been no ransom, no note, no communication.
No.
It's been now just over a year.
Yeah.
Sarmad Ali is now working as a journalist with the Wall Street Journal. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. So Sarmad has been living for the past year wondering about the fate of his father in Baghdad. I asked him what his family wants or expects from him now.
My brother keeps pushing me to go home, go back home and help. But my mother, she said I should stay here because it's not safe there. And even like just 2 days ago, I was talking to my friend on the phone about the possibilities of trying to get my family some help and get them out to a neighboring country. And I was just asking him about what happened to people, if he knew any people who were outside Iraq for a while anywhere and got back to Iraq, what's the general impression? Yeah. And he was saying that I can't even go to my neighborhood now, even if I were able to go to Iraq. And most people wouldn't see their families in their neighborhoods. They would meet them secretly somewhere, in a hotel, in a park, somewhere else, in a relative's place, but not in the same neighborhood. Because once people in your neighborhood know that you've been gone for a long time, they start inquiring, where is this person? Then you showed up out of the blue again, then this is not good. You might be kidnapped for ransom, you might be killed. There are all these crazy things that are happening, which is really, really sad.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, is that clearly it's been awful for them, but it must be difficult for you, living so far away, not able to do anything but make a long-distance telephone call.
Basically, or try to ask some close friends to do me favors from time to time to check on them or buy them something or see if they need something, things like that.
Do you feel like you've let your family down by not going back?
I've been really thinking about this a lot. I sometimes do feel that way, but at the same time, I feel like if I were there, what could I do possibly to help them there? Yeah. I'll be like as stuck as they are, and I won't be able to help as much from there.
And what about your father, Sarmad, when... As I mentioned, it's been now more than a year since he disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do to keep him alive in your mind?
Well, basically, I remember things. I remember my childhood, like holidays with them. I remember him taking me to the parks. I remember him taking me to the movies, to restaurants. I remember the good days.
Did he give you anything? Did he ever sort of pass along a piece of advice to you that you hold on to even now?
Yeah, he was always suspicious of things. Like, he always made me think, for example, twice before considering an offer, considering any risk, considering anything in life.
Can you think of a time or a circumstance when you used his advice, when you know, you could hear him whispering in your ear and you were cautious?
I remember, for example, when I was working in the English language paper in Iraq, I remember taking a cab from the paper to my home. And I was carrying some of the old issues of the paper, and it was in English. And the cab driver was from probably the south or something, or from Sadr City. And probably he didn't read English. And he said, "Why are you carrying these newspapers?" I said, I looked at him, and I knew why he asked the question. I knew that he didn't ask the question to know why. He wanted to say something threatening. And I remembered my father's advice, and I couldn't tell him the truth. I couldn't tell him that I was working that paper. I told him that I bought these newspapers to study. I study English, and I needed them to improve my language, just to read it. Although I was a reporter in that paper, I couldn't tell him that. I was really cautious about how much information I should impart on strangers like him who could be a threat.
And what's ahead for you, Sarmad? Can you make a life for yourself in New York? Do you feel like at some point you have to go back to Iraq? How do you think about the long-term future for yourself?
Life here has been good in general. Yeah. I've been really getting along in this society. I've made so many friends. I have like surrogate families here. They invite me to holidays and these things. And I don't feel estranged here. I feel like I'm part of this city. So I feel like it's kind of a home to me now. At some point, I'd love to go back and see my family at least, like spend time with them.
Do you ever feel guilty knowing what your family is still living through in Baghdad?
I do. I do actually a lot of time. Like, for example, just in September, I was in the Sierra Nevada, like in the mountains, and I was hiking. And then I remembered my family. I remembered I stopped like in front of the mountain looking at the beautiful scene. And then I was like, oh my God, there are so many people, so many loved ones to my heart that would never probably see this place, that they would never enjoy it the way I'm enjoying it. I do feel sometimes guilty of having access to everything, to many things here that people there can't even dream of.
Sarmad Ali is a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. He also writes the journal blog called Baghdad Life, and you can find a link to his work on our website at thestory.org. In just a moment, we'll revisit a story I did earlier, men in prison who are getting old there and coming to terms with the prospect of dying behind bars. I'll talk with a daughter who's watching her father grow old in prison. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Over the past 20 years, there's been a significant increase in the number of men and women locked away in prison in the U.S. These days, a considerable number of them are getting older. This raises questions for all of us about the rise in the cost of health care and nursing home care for inmates. It also has the men who are locked away wondering what's ahead for them. Now, just to remind us, here are two of the men I spoke with earlier, Harold Watkins and Joe Hunt.
At this place, I see death all the time because people constantly die here. And when I'm laying in bed at night a lot of times, yeah, I wake up and think about things like that. But I shut my eyes and I pray, Lord, help me get out of here. You know what I mean? Help me not die here. Help me get where I can see my granddaughter.
If the parole board would even turn me down on my past record, I wouldn't feel bad about it. Because of the crimes and the chances that I had been given before. See, and I messed it up, and here I am. But I still think that a person that's old and no threat, he ain't no good for nothing, they should have a place for him.
The two prisoners, Joe and Harold, talked with me at McCain Correctional Hospital in Rayford, North Carolina. Heather McKeever heard both of them talking on the radio.
Listening to them talk about growing old in prison just brought to mind what my dad's going to go through. And it's something that I'm kind of been trying to avoid thinking about.
The case of Heather's father made the national news. Ronald McKeever was a doctor in his early 60s who specialized in treating pain. He came to the attention of the authorities because he gave liberal prescriptions of narcotic pain drugs like OxyContin, and he was eventually convicted and jailed on a drug charge. He got 30 years. His daughter Heather hasn't given up hope of seeing her father walk free, but with few legal options left, she says she's just recently started to think that he may spend the rest of his life in jail.
I didn't really take it that seriously at the beginning. In fact, he didn't really let me know much about what was going on until shortly before the trial. But when I heard about the trial, I just assumed there would be some suspension of his license or he would be levied some huge fine or something like that. I had no idea that he'd be sent to prison for 30 years.
What was your feeling at the time? Were you heartbroken at the idea that your dad was going to spend all this time in prison? Were you angry with him that he'd let it get to this stage? What were you thinking?
Yeah, there have been a huge number of emotions over the time period. And when this first happens, you're wrapped up in, well, the appeal, you know, we're going to get the appeal. And so
we'll fix this, right?
We spent months kind of looking toward that end goal. And certainly this can't hold, certainly, because it just seemed so ludicrous.
Was there a time when it all became real to you that your dad was?
Yeah, that didn't happen until after the appeal. Yeah, when the appeal was denied and when I read the transcript from the trial as well, and I kind of had this sense of like, ah, I should have been there to, you know, guide them or something, because it was, they just didn't ask the right questions, you know. But that was, you know, you go through this kind of anger and injustice phase. And then after the appeal is denied, it really started to sink in. And when I, you know, it brings to mind the other emotion that comes up for me, which is guilt. You know, there's this sense that if I had done or were doing more to fight his case, you know, that maybe it wouldn't turn out this way, or that by my sort of getting on with my life and keeping busy with my work and my family, you know, that I'm somehow abandoning him. There have been a huge number of emotions over the time period. And I think that I've definitely been through fear for him and anger, both at the system that convicted him and at him.
Part of you thinking, Dad, you could have avoided
this,
right?
Yeah. Exactly, exactly.
Did he get the kind of Martha Stewart comfort jail treatment when
he
was put away?
He spent his first year in a county facility in South Carolina. And during that time, he was in, I think it was like an 8x8 cell that he was required to stay in 23 hours a day. Obviously, he didn't get much exercise. And as you can probably assume, food in prison is pretty bad. He said that he didn't even see anything that resembled a vegetable for that whole year. So he gained 100 pounds over that year. He was already a little bit overweight, but he gained 100 pounds, and he ended up having a heart attack.
In the county jail?
Yeah, yeah. And so that was treated, caught, luckily caught, I think, just in time, and he recovered from that. And I think it was actually, that was an event that got his transfer to a federal facilitate a little bit faster, because he did need medical care.
And has he got slightly better care? Or
He has gotten better care in the federal system, and he's able to walk around, and he walks 4 or 5 miles a day now, and he's lost all of that weight. And in fact, he's probably in better health now than he was when he went in.
None of the stress of being a doctor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, how far apart are you physically right now? You're in Greensboro. Where's he being held?
He's in Estill, South Carolina,
so
which is about
that?
6-hour drive.
And do you get down to see him fairly often?
I haven't been down there yet. He was transferred there a few months ago.
Do you find that you saw this all in kind of selfish terms, where you're thinking to yourself, well, now I'll have to go to prison to see my dad, or, you know, he won't know his granddaughter,
sure,
or that sort of thing?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even down to, you know, that I periodically send him things, you know, books and things to keep him interested. And my mother, who's actually his ex-wife, sends him money so that he can make phone calls.
I mean, he's dependent on you.
He's dependent
for this,
on
right?
us for that.
Yeah.
And his own family, you know, his wife and daughter are basically now destitute. They've lost everything. So it's kind of up to us to pass him what little money we can, just so that he can continue to communicate with the outside world. And I guess in some ways I do feel like this isn't supposed to be my role. You know.
Your dad's now what, 65?
Yeah, he was born in 43, so.
So he'll celebrate his 65th mm-hmm. birthday this year. And how has having your father in jail affected the relationship that you have with him?
It's created a relationship that is different, and it's very bizarre. It's a relationship similar to what we had when I was maybe an older teenager, in the sense that we talk about things and what's going on and with my daughter, or what he's learning, or whatever. It's more of a friendship relationship almost. But the roles are really reversed, in the sense of I can't get much from him You know, I can get emotional support from him when he calls for, usually we talk about 5 to 6 minutes at a time before they cut us off.
You get one of these messages that says, will you accept a collect call from this jail? Blah, blah,
blah. Yeah. Okay. And then about every minute they break in with, this call is from a federal facility. And so
I've heard those calls.
Yeah. So it's difficult because I feel like the relationship is stunted. I feel like it's, like, I'm not going to be able to grow with him. He's not going to see my grandchildren
grow. But it's funny in a way, Heather, because he's got nothing to give.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, in a way, he's convicted of a crime. He has a routine that is constrained by the walls of a prison.
Yeah.
You know, what happened yesterday is probably pretty close to what happened the day before that, right?
Yeah, yeah. So there's not much to talk about in that sense.
Does that mean that he looks to you then for news rather than you saying, hey, Dad, what's up with, what's going on with you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so do you scribble little notes on a piece of paper beside the phone, remember to tell Dad this when he calls so you don't run out of things to say? I mean,
I usually fill the time up with stories about my daughter.
You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. I'm Dick Gordon. Heather McKeever's talking about the prospect that her father will grow old and die in prison. Heather recently took her young daughter to meet her dad. The little girl was born about the time of his trial.
He's met her when she was about five or six months old. And then she went to visit him. I took her to visit him one time this past year. And that was a really awkward situation as well. For me to decide, do I take her? And what do I tell her when I take her? Because, you know, going to visit somebody in prison is pretty scary. You walk in and you're scanned and your shoes are scanned and you have to empty all your pockets. And
your daughter's how old at this
time? She's three. She was
when she went
not quite three when she went.
Yeah, so there's a reasonable expectation that she'll remember this trip, right?
Yeah.
Which is what you're thinking about.
Exactly.
No doubt.
And then the doors are closing behind you and everyone has to march in a straight line and that kind of thing. So,
what have you said to her prior to this?
I hadn't said much. I said, we're going to see him where he lives. And she accepted that. And she didn't ask many questions at that time. You know, where are we? What are we doing? I expected her to ask more and I certainly would have answered them if she had. But she didn't really ask. And so I just kind of let it be like we were visiting him at camp or something like that. And since then, she said she's seen a picture of some institutional-looking building, and she said, that looks like the building where your dad lives, you know. So she knows that he lives someplace like that, but she doesn't understand what's going on exactly.
And did you get to meet with him in the same room or through the glass? What happened?
Yeah, you can have full contact visitation. It's basically a big room where all the prisoners and all the guests are there at the same time. But they have a kids' area, and she was able to run around and play with games, and he was able to have her sit on his lap and read her a story and that kind of thing.
How was that for both of you?
That was good. It was good. He just started crying when he saw her because he didn't know she was coming. I hadn't told him. And he had been asking me to bring her and I'd been kind of hedging because I really didn't know if I wanted to expose her to that or not. But it was near Father's Day and I decided that that was a good thing to do, that she should know who he is. So it was really exciting for him. And she eventually warmed up to him and really enjoyed the visit as well.
Yeah. So the reservations that you had before you went, were those wiped away or do you still think, oh, man, you know, was that the right thing? Is this a good thing to take a little girl into a place like
I still have those reservations for sure.
And what are they? That she'll remember the jail, not her grandfather? What do you think?
I think for me it's the conversation about what we do with people when they commit crimes. You know, it's the conversation about people being not having freedom of movement and not being able to do things that they want to do. So I think that's the difficult conversation that I'm trying to avoid.
What about other relationships? What about the way that your father, now what, in his third year in prison, has changed in relations with other family members? What do you see there?
This has obviously given him a lot of time to think and to try to reestablish connections, and he has taken advantage of that to a good degree. He had a sister that he was in pretty minimal communication with beforehand. But I do know that his sister has been to visit him and has written to him and that they've kind of repaired a lot of that relationship. His relationship with my sister has actually grown. My sister's younger, and before he went into prison, they were kind of in that kind of young adult daughter father difficulty time. And so she's been able to go and sit with him and have long conversations and really get that one-on-one time with him that she needed. And I think their relationship has actually blossomed since this has happened.
I'm almost drawn, Heather, to ask you if then, you know, there are benefits that balance the negatives of having your father locked away in prison for what's likely to be the rest of his life. But what do you think?
I don't know. I think that you get to the end of your life and you look back and probably lots of things have turned out to be beneficial that you wouldn't have seen at the time. I don't know if that I would say it's an even balance, but I definitely think there are some good things that have come. He's been tutoring a lot, and I think there was a GED course or something he was teaching, and that was really fulfilling for him. He was actually a teacher before he became a doctor. And so I think he's using all of those skills, and I think he's regaining some sense of kind of accomplishment and self-worth from some of those things.
And what does he give back to you in terms of his sense of his predicament now? Does he put a happier face on his life?
Yeah, I think he does.
So you don't worry?
Yeah, I think he does. He's very worried about his wife, his current wife, and his daughter, who's only 14.
They've been left without a lot of money, right, since he went to jail?
Yeah. And she's in poor health, so that makes things even more difficult. So he worries about them a lot, and he doesn't really talk to me about that, I think, partly because of what you're saying. He doesn't want me to then worry about that. And in terms of how it is for him to kind of face 30 years, we kind of avoid that conversation as well. And it's the kind of thing that at some point one or the other of us will bring up, because we do have a very open, emotionally mature relationship in a lot of ways. And previous to him going in, we would talk about these things for sure. So I know that it'll come up at some point. I think that, I don't know if it's just me, but it's I definitely haven't been ready for that conversation until recently.
Well, it's funny in a way because, you know, for you to have that time with a father when the time is set by other people, like it's visiting hours. It's not, we went for a drive and I thought this would be the perfect time to bring it up. Right,
exactly. So you kind of have to push that button to accept the call and say, Dad, you're getting old in prison. What's it like? Talk to me. you have to bypass all the short talk in order to have a conversation like that.
Is he in any way feeling that there's stuff that he wishes he wasn't missing? Family events, birth, death, stuff like that. Yeah. Does he talk about that?
Oh, he talks about, you know, missing my daughters growing up. And he loves kids. He's kind of the fun dad. Hmm. And he was so excited when he found out I was pregnant. He really talks about missing. He calls her Ike.
Your daughter.
That's not her name, but that's what he calls her. And because he thinks she looks like Eisenhower.
When she gets hair. She'll look better.
So he really misses that. And he's missing a pretty crucial time in his other daughter's life as well. And I think that he probably can't talk about that.
Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
Heather McKeever joined me here in the studio. If you want to read more about her story and her father's case, we have a link on our website at thestory.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Story, a trip to the tattoo parlor. No, I'm not going to get that anchor I've always dreamed of. It'll be a closer look into the changing world of the memorial tattoo. I'm going to talk with Garrett Sample when his younger brother Vance got killed. Garrett got a tattoo with a gun on it. Later on, he wanted to change that tattoo, and he explained to the tattoo artist that he wanted a scroll tattooed over top to remember his brother.
I remember him in so many different ways. So at the time, I'd never seen anybody with a scroll. Scrolls are a good way. It's almost like a biblical way to do it. And he said, you just tell me certain things about him that you would like to remember, and, you know, we'll go from there with it. But, I mean, every morning I wake up, if I look in the mirror, I can see it perfect. It's almost like retiring a jersey. Even though you're retiring a jersey, you know, in spirit, the person is still here. You'll always remember, you know, the things they did and how they did it. and the effect they had on you in the particular lives of other people that you were close with.
Remembering people with tattoos? That's the story tomorrow. Remember, our website is the place to get in touch with me for thoughts about what you're hearing on the program or your own ideas for stories, characters that you'd like to hear on the program. A lot of what you hear on this program comes from listeners, more than you'd ever imagine. So if you're thinking about a story and wondering if we'd be interested, well, give us a couple of lines, let us know, and one of the producers here will be in touch with you. You can do this through our website at thestory.org, or you can leave me a message on the telephone line here, 1-888-966-9862, 1-888-966-9862. You can also write me, care of The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, the zip code 27517. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.